There's a lot of possibilities. The fact that we can do our work more independently, share our work more independently, we don't have to mince words, we don't have to self-limit what we want to say. I think all of that is hugely liberating.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Bangladesh's development story in the 21st century is often regarded as a model of resilience and progress. And in the first two decades of the century, government figures claim average GDP growth of 6.4%, and that goes along with huge declines in poverty, infant mortality, and big rises as well in literacy or life expectancy or exports. But on the 5th of August 2024, student-led protests and public unrest caused Sheikh Hasina, Bangladesh's Prime Minister, to resign and flee to India. And an interim government led by Muhammad Yunus, Nobel laureate of course, took over. Now, 6 months on, Bangladesh's political and economic future is unclear, and there's a lively debate at the moment about what democracy should mean in future and what changes to government policy there should be. So, how can fresh evidence on the state of the economy and the aspirations of its citizens help shape that future? Imran Matin, Executive Director of the BRAC Institute of Government and Development, BIGD, is one of the experts in Bangladesh who are attempting to discover and communicate a clearer picture of the country's present and options for the future. And he joins me now. Imran, welcome.
Hi. Thanks a lot, Tim.
Imran, I gave the headlines of the revolution in Bangladesh in 2024, at least how it was presented to outsiders. What events led up to this?
Right. So I think it's a mix of factors. It's a great example of pursuing growth and development without paying attention to governance and not paying attention to basic freedoms and basic liberty. And I think what led to this unfolding of events actually started off with a lack of real progress in terms of basic livelihoods, what one might call positive freedom. The source, the base of the uprising was economic, lack of real felt economic progress in the everyday lives of large majority of people. Mm-hmm. That was really at the heart of it. Since COVID, I think it was particularly bad, but I think a lot of the vulnerabilities existed even before that, but then COVID and the Ukraine war made it really worse. And there was a big denial in terms of the plight of the large majority of the people in terms of any policy response. So on the one hand, you had a denial that all these are temporary and growth will take care of it and is indeed taking care of it. And there was data, a lot of it was being manufactured to really come up with these type of narratives. And on the other hand, I think in the last 2-3 years, there was also a big media news about large amounts of pilferage of money from Bangladesh. And this happened actually in the last 2-3 years. And, you know, I mean, even before the uprising. So I think it was a combination of the denial of the actual plight of large majority of people on the one hand. And on the other hand, the sheer injustice in the way the economy was being run in terms of a winner-takes-all type of a growth strategy, which was actually being pilfered out of the country, and the sheer lack of governance in the financial sector, in the banking sector, that was emerging in the news reports in the last year or two, led to a real, I think, the grounds for the uprising to happen. And of course, combined with that is the political repression that happened over the last 15, 16 years, especially in the last 10 years. And I think that obviously was an underlying fire that was burning, which really got sparked by the economic downturns really that was happening.
A lot clearly has changed since August 2024. But what institutions of government remain? How are they functioning? What's their task at the moment?
That's really the big challenge right now. I mean, in some ways, the kind of the stability and the basic kind of running of the everyday economy that's going on right now, I think is in many ways remarkable, given the kind of events that led to this uprising in August 5th. But I think the big challenge right now is really getting the private sector and the bureaucracy to sort of get that to work with the interim government to be able to shape the kind of political future that we want to basically create. And the downside here is that does not happen, then some of the key reform agenda will be hurried and will lead to half-baked reform agenda with a hurried election, which will essentially not be able to deliver the kind of changes for which so much sacrifice has been done.
You're talking about the huge sacrifices. Does the interim government at the moment have popular support?
We from BIGT, we've been running citizen perception surveys since 2019. It's a national representative survey, and we have been continuing the citizen perception survey just after the July uprising. So we had one in August and one again in October-November period. We're planning to continue this pulse survey, that's what we're calling it.
Mm-hmm.
What we find is, yes, as one would expect, there was a huge surge in economic and political optimism in terms of the direction of the country just after the August uprising. However, that has plummeted by October, November. And particularly, it's the economic direction that we see a huge decline in the mood of the people. Whereas the political optimism largely, I think, remains. So I think we're in a situation where if the economic management is not prioritized and delivered on with some key areas which common people are facing in the everyday felt economic lives, if that does not happen, then I think the political optimism that exists right now with the interim government will dwindle as well, which would then lead to a situation of greater impatience with the reform agenda, and then leading to an election that is a bit premature, leading to a future that would be less hopeful and promising than it could have been. It would certainly be, I think, still better than where we were before, especially in terms of governance. But I think we would be deeply underpunching given what has happened during this huge unprecedented uprising if we do not pay attention to the economic management issues right now.
What are the next steps? How will you know when it is time to hold the elections and transition away from this interim government?
I think a lot of this depends, of course, on the political process, right? I mean, it would depend on how the interim government actually holds conversations with the political parties, particularly around the reform recommendations. The reform recommendations are already coming in, and there's another meta-level commission that has been formed with the Honorable Chief Advisor himself leading that, and it's called a Commission for Consensus. And this would basically try and get a political consensus on the recommendations and really come up, hammer out the priority consensus recommendations. That will determine how quickly we can hold the election. And I think the chief advisor has already said that it will be December or June next year, depending on how much progress, what are the key recommendations and how much progress we want to make before the election is held. And that also would be a political conversation that will determine that. So not only the key recommendations, but how much progress we want to make before we think that is the minimum progress we want to make before the election is held.
I'm talking to you today because you have a very interesting, significant role within this transition as part of the BRAC Institute of Governance and Development, BIGD. First of all, can you explain to us what BIGD is?
BIGD, we are a social science research and a postgraduate teaching institute of BRAC University.
Mm-hmm.
As our name suggests, we're a research organization that tries to look at governance and development in an interdependent way. We're interested in both of this agenda, and we want to take a very field research-oriented approach to looking at the complex of governance and development, because, you know, we believe that, you know, the biggest value we can add is really understanding how things are on the ground and solutions based on the real life experiences of people themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So we really see ourselves as a field research organization on governance and development. And given the current times, I think this is an agenda that has got a lot of importance.
And you personally have a role in this administration. Maybe that came as a surprise to you to be part of Bangladesh's history at this point. but it's a committee, as I understand it, to analyze what's happening in Bangladesh's economy. Tell me about this committee and what you are expected to produce.
So first of all, this is a committee that is independent.
Yeah.
We are an independent committee of experts that is formed by the interim government, and the chief advisor himself has sort of formed this. Our role is essentially to do, in some ways, a very new thing that hasn't really happened in Bangladesh before, but it's something that happens a lot in the UK. So we're doing a white paper on AOER.
Uh-huh.
So it's a transparency exercise to provide an expert view in terms of where we are and how we got there as well. So 90% of our work is where we are and how we got there. And we also provided some future directions, but we will hopefully contribute to the reform agenda. But recommending on reforms was not part of our mandate. So ours is very much a backward looking and a more process oriented sort of look at where we are. We were a group of 11 experts led by Dr. Debaprem Bhattacharya. And we were a group of macroeconomists, energy specialists, public expenditure specialists, people like myself working on poverty issues. And then we had somebody working on employment and overseas migration as well. So we tried to cover all the different dimensions of the economy, ranging from macro to micro to social, to structural and institutional as well, to really provide as comprehensive a view as we could based on existing data that was there, and also talking to people. We held over 60 consultations with sort of different stakeholders to sort of come to a considered view in terms of where we are in terms of the state of the economy.
There are official government statistics from the previous regime, but based on what you've already said to me, it sounds like you do not believe those statistics.
That's largely true. I mean, what we have been saying is one of the major culprit, if you like, of the narrative, growth and development narrative that has been created and which has been fed to everyone, I think, is data itself. So data and media are the two pillars which I think have played a role in terms of creating the overall narrative. So yes, there's a lot of distrust in the data. Primarily, I think not so much in terms of the poverty data. I think the household income expenditure surveys, the labor force surveys, I mean, there are technical problems, especially in the household income expenditure survey. I think that has been because of the partnership with the World Bank, particularly. I think that has been largely done very well. There are technical issues that one could talk about, but I don't think there's been a lot of problems in terms of manipulating that data. Whereas I think the formative foundational data, for instance, data on export, data on investment, data on inflation, that you need to do any type of economic planning and forecasting and economic policy level conversations have been tempered with. This is where the biggest challenge lies. In the white paper, we have been talking a lot about how to make data more independent. I think that should be data governance, and data independence has to be a central reform agenda for the future of good economic planning.
You have already mentioned the Rapid Research Response Initiative that BIGD has launched to collect data to support the work of the interim government. What are you collecting? How do you do it? It must be very difficult to get any rigorous information at a time like this.
We're calling this pulse survey. Mm-hmm. So the idea is to basically have a very small set of questions that we are sort of continuing over time. And the idea is at some point we want to do a health test. I mean, yeah. You know, it's more comprehensive. We're doing it fast. It has to be rapid. So we learned a lot about how to do good quality phone survey. We had this phone database of a survey that we have been doing since 2019. It was a national representative survey in partnership with the Asia Foundation. We used that sample base. We have pretty detailed protocols in terms of quality checks of phone survey data. Then we have, you know, over 70% sort of retention, right? Success rate, really, which is quite high for a phone survey. And we now have panel data on the phone survey as well over time. And we wish to continue this for at least two or three more rounds before we do an in-person survey where we would really have more comprehensive health check of the economy and society, people's perceptions. Right now, it's a 10, 15 minute long phone survey that we are basically doing.
In that 10 or 15 minutes, what are you discovering? What insights do you hope to discover?
One question that we keep on asking is sort of the economic and political direction of the country. I just mentioned that, and we have this in 2019. And the overtime data of this is extremely interesting. And I told you about the results. On top of that, we collect information on major challenges, major problems that people are facing, you know, from an economic point of view, on safety, security issues. And then we right now are asking some topical questions, such as how long do people want the interim government to be in place for? When do they want the election? Which party they would vote for. I think as time passes, we're going to have questions more around the electoral choices. All this will help us to form the kind of hypothesis that we want to really explore more deeply in the in-person survey that we want to do maybe in a few months' time.
So it's often a frustration for researchers to be able to have their evidence adopted because governments have committed to a policy direction for political rather than sound economic research-based reasons. Well, you are not in this position at the moment. There is perhaps a clean slate here. Is this a special opportunity to create some evidence-based policy reform?
Yeah, that's very much the hope. And I think there is a lot of interest in terms of having more evidence-based decisions. The reality also is that there are a lot of competing priorities right now. Getting adequate support from the bureaucracy is ultimately as the implementation arm of any policy. And, you know, one of the things that I think we often take for granted or we don't explore hard enough is the role of bureaucracy. And I think understanding bureaucracy and bureaucracy motivation and bureaucracy incentives and the mechanics of bureaucracy is one of the central areas that I think researchers need to take far more seriously if they want evidence-based policy. And I'm realizing that in many ways, this is coming home to us, that that needs to be made far more explicit if you want evidence to sort of policy to happen well. But yes, there is a lot more openings. There is a lot more appetite for listening, but there are competing priorities. There are constraints as well. What would be really is something that we are talking with the interim government is to sort of really think about some big ticket and some very small immediate things that the interim government should really think in terms of legacy. I think one big legacy that the interim government could really focus on is a more direct action on poverty. And I think given that the absolute number of poor people are on the rise right now, we are backtracking globally. Yes, we obviously are, but in Bangladesh, absolutely we are in terms of SDG 1. And there are solutions that have proven came from Bangladesh, such as the graduation approach, productive safety net. So I think this is the time, and this is something that we are really trying to get the interim government to leave behind as a legacy, which they can clearly do, is to have a very ambitious, aggressive, productive safety net program with good evidence so that the next political government that comes to power will consider three times before letting it go because there is such strong evidence behind it. And that's going to be really, really important to really push forward.
As you've already seen from your surveys, that people can be very impatient for change, and rightly so. They are justified in thinking that way. How quickly do you think you will be able to make these changes? Do large changes have to wait for another government?
Ultimately, the big changes will have to be taken forward by a political government. It's a relay race, you know, it's only up to a level that interim government, this is not a political government, but it has a huge mandate, even more than political governments in many ways. But it is also a mandate with a very narrow window of opportunity. Mm-hmm. I think there's about a year, but I think within the next 3-4 months, there's going to be impatience is going to really grow. I really think the month of Ramadan that's basically coming up, this is where the big test is going to be in terms of food, keeping market stable in terms of food prices. That's going to be a big challenge. April, May is going to be the time when there's going to be a big harvest, the big investment that will be needed, March, April, May period, around that time for irrigation. So the fuel cost. So I think the food, fuel, and I think foreign exchange reserve, these are the three, forex, food, and fuel. These three Fs are going to be critical in the next 3-4 months. Unless this can be solved at a level that is visible and is felt by people in their everyday lives, I think just talking about the longer term reforms, more structural ones, are going to get impeded.
And meanwhile, during this period of change, BRAC's work continues. last year, you had very severe floods in Bangladesh. I believe that they were the worst for several decades. How is BRAC's ability to deliver humanitarian aid where it's needed? How is that affected by the change that's going on at the moment?
I can speak from kind of an insider-outsider with BRAC University, but clearly we work very closely with BRAC. I think BRAC is taking on very ambitious programs. You know, I mean, they sort of continue to really, really focus on the immediate needs. During the flood, there was a huge response from BRAC. But I think right now, I think the focus is very much on job creation, on employment. You know, not so much job creation, but for instance, there's a new program that BRAC is just starting. There is a large number of women, especially during COVID, who have withdrawn from the labor market, how to get them back. So I think BRAC is really thinking about that particular segment. I think BRAC skills development program, I think, is expanding very, very fast as well. So that's another area BRAC is really focusing on. I think it's ultra-poor graduation program, especially in the more climate-affected areas, I think is taking on new energy. BRAC is bringing together a number of its poverty-oriented program to create a kind of a thematic focus on poverty. I think SDG 1 is very much back on BRAC's agenda in a very serious way. So I think, yes, jobs and poverty, I think BRAC is really taking those areas extremely seriously.
And personally, for you, how does this moment feel? Is it exciting because of the work you have to do, or are you also fearful for what might happen next?
There's a lot of possibilities. The fact that we can do our work more independently, share our work more independently, we don't have to mince words, we don't have to self-limit what we want to say. I think all of that is hugely liberating. I think the fact that this is a moment of a real urgency for a nation building is, I think, really, really motivating people to come together. FCDO has just supported a group of research think tanks to come together and provide some institutional grant to strengthen that this research think tank organization. The July-August uprising has given us even more impetus right now to really work together. So I think that the sense of collective agenda is very strong. I think we all are very, very concerned also, you know. I mean, the GDP growth rate have been overestimated, but we are at a place where the economy will grow at a much slower rate. We have debts that we have to start repaying very soon. The grace period of these debts are coming to an end. The foreign exchange issue is sort of very much out there. So I think in terms of the macro and the poverty situation, I think there is deep reason for concern. There are many reasons to be very concerned about. But there are many, many reasons for which to work together and come together fast to see whether we could take advantage of this time that we are in right now.
Imran, we wish you luck. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
Please look up BRAC.net to see what's happening with BRAC's work at the moment, but also look into what's happening at BRAC University and BIGD. That's at BRACU, BRACU.ac.bd. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe. You find us wherever you get your podcasts. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org. If you like what you're hearing, please leave us a review and tell someone else about us.